Okay, my name is Eunah Kim. I'm at Cornell University. I've been there a little less than a year now. As a post-Woodstock generation, it's really exciting to be here to tell you, the audience, from whose work I learned a lot over the time. So it's really exciting to tell you what we have found very recently. And what I'm going to address just turned out that happens to be one right on the issue Jan raised, the third question, which was about looking for the experimental sharp signatures for whatever symmetry that you're after. And there were a couple other questions, like there was also a very important question related to Phil's question, which is this all red herring, and so on. I'll try to do my best at commenting on some of these issues based on what we found in these two systems. So on the left-hand side is YBC, related to YBCO. On the right-hand side is related to BISCO. And I'm asking the question, does electronic pneumatic exist in cuprates? So these are the questions that I hope to be able to address. And it's a privilege to be able to acknowledge my colleagues from whom I learned so much. It's been such a pleasure and exciting to look for these signatures together with my colleagues. Michael Lawler is here, and Dr. Kaisun visited Cornell for a couple of days, and we had this whole exciting idea and worked this out. Professor James Cessna is my colleague. Dr. Andy Schmidt is another amazing colleague who's also here, and Seamus, I think you all know. So, these are the outline. I'm going to discuss spin and charge aspect of electronic pneumatic in BISCO, in YBCO, and in BISCO, I'm going to ask the question, does it have pneumatic? So, before I move on, because this is a pretty broad audience spanning large generation, I thought I would try to define what I mean by what. So, usually when we heat up a crystal, it will melt at some particular temperature. That's probably your first chemistry experiment that you do, and you measure the melting temperature. And Reinitzer, about 200-something years ago, did that very experiment on this compound that he extracted from carrots. And he found that it was first melting into a cloudy liquid, and then at certain well-defined temperature, it suddenly became a clear liquid. He didn't know what he was seeing. He went to talk to his physicist friend, and the physicist friend told him that he was seeing two phase transitions. And that's how the pneumatic, which is an intermediate state between crystal and liquid, so-called liquid crystal, was discovered. Now we know SMECTIC exists as well. But from the discovery of Reinitzer, it took almost 100 years before people could identify what was the nature of the symmetry breaking, before figuring out what is the right order parameter to look for, and that was the contribution of Leighton Gen. These authors had this idea, maybe perhaps the same kind of thing can happen in the electronic systems when it cannot decide whether it wants to be local or wants to be delocalized. And it might happen as a function of temperature, but perhaps you might be able to tune the interaction with a particular parameter of your interest, and it might happen as a quantum phase transition. And you can view it from a momentum space picture as well. Now, what I'm going to focus on is the pneumatic, which is the state which breaks rotational symmetry but does not break translational symmetry. This has been seen in, I can say, sufficiently correlated systems. There are a number of systems that has been exhibiting some of these phenomena, and today I'm going to focus on cuprates. So when we want to discuss this particular symmetry breaking in cuprates, we want to ask, what is the right way of quantifying broken symmetry from the data? But at the same time, as a theorist, I want to ask whether such broken symmetry, or say if I want to discuss a critical point, does that have theoretical right to exist? And this is a conversation between data and myself. Now, if we find a way to quantify, we would try to make a phenomenological model, And whether if we are happy with the licensing process, we will be more comfortable doing that. But then we can ask a harder question, which is, let's say we found that the system does break this particular symmetry, we can ask, why would the system want to do that? Why would Cuprate want to do that? And we can also ask, is it useful for superconductivity? Now, you can tell the order in which these questions appeared are perhaps in the increasing degree of difficulty. And I'm going to mainly focus on these set of questions, partially because some of these topics are rather new and required development in experimental technology, and also because I'm young. That is, I have more time to try to think about these questions. Okay, so I don't have a lot of time to discuss some of the earlier issues, but I can flash some of those. If you have questions, you can discuss further. We asked the question whether the pneumatic quantum critical point has a license to exist. That is, whether a critical point defined as a fixed point of RG, in the RG sense, is a stable fixed point. Here we define the pneumatic inside the superconductor in terms of what happens to the symmetry of the nodal position. When the four nodes are not exactly at 45 degree direction, then that is breaking C4 symmetry. Now, nodal quasiparticles are only low-lying excitations inside superconductor, and this is a way of quantifying pneumatic state inside a superconductor. And to be more specific, pneumatic superconductor can be stated as a D-wave superconductor with a small S-wave component, which would make A direction different from B direction. Now, we also thought about what would be the effect of such pneumatic critical fluctuations. And if you have questions, we can go more into that later. But today, I want to come back to the question of what are the experimental sharp signatures, and what can we do with that in terms of phenomenological model. So in YBCO, there was this beautiful experiment by Keimer's group, Hinkoff et al., which was published in Science last year. What they found was that there was energy and temperature dependent anisotropy in the inelastic neutron signal. So this is a point that's pi pi around pi pi. One cut behaves differently from the other cut. And this incommensurability seemed to behave as if it serves as some sort of order parameter. However, this is an inelastic measurement. And why should this incommensurability behave like some sort of order parameter with this T minus T star, which is the onset temperature to the half power? And what we wanted to understand was, can we make sense out of this phenomena that's seen in the spin channel and what was observed earlier by Ando et al. In the charge channel through the charge transport. And this simple story goes as realizing that, well, if the system is very close to being an antiferromagnet, you can think of a simple phenomenological model where you have a decoherence scale, and there is some sort of gap scale because your spin waves are not gapless without the long range order. So this is the simple quadratic action we started thinking about, and this was really Kai's idea. And we realized that, okay, from here to there is trivial, and this is one quantity we can try to compare with experiments. Now then it boils down to trying to model what would be the symmetry allowed way of thinking about this gap in the spin wave spectrum. And the simplest thing we can do was to think about what are the various contributions away from the pi-pi direction if you are to do the gradient expansion. And this n is the charge pneumatic order parameter. So it boils down to saying, well, this is a term that's allowed by symmetry. It's a linear coupling between charge pneumatic order parameter and the spin wave, but it's entering with as a gradient expansion. And with this picture, what this allows us to do is to make one direction softer than the other as the pneumatic order parameter turns on. So we could model this measurement, and we could model this quantity, and we got a reasonable fit. Now, we have a lot of parameters, and it's not the fit that I'm most proud of. It's just something we could do, therefore we did it. However, what we were excited about was the fact that we can actually, from this measurement, think about how to view this phenomena, so-called fluctuating spin strike. When you say something is fluctuating, it's not really a phase, but we could understand this fluctuating spin strike phenomena as reflecting symmetry breaking in the charge channel. And this is the phase diagram we draw. Now, this was all fun. And what made this really fun was that when you're talking about a diffraction measurement, you have one quantity that you're trying to model. It's a bulk measurement, and you can say a lot about what's going on in the system with a one quantity. However, what we saw earlier in this morning was STM in BSCO, which is a local measurement, which means if you talk to these students, they will show you at this each of these points, they have almost infinite to my scale number of spectra. There is an awful lot of information in these images. And what we wanted, what we've been struggling with for over last year was to figure out, is there a way of, again, making a sharp statement in a quantitative way? So these are some data that's been collected over the years. And if you look at this, you see a little bit of a domain that is perhaps breaking translational symmetry and also breaking rotational symmetry a little bit. This is the R map, which is the ratio of current, tunneling current, and this is Z map at different energies. So we look at this and we try to see, is there a way of studying this in a quantitative way? Can we define a correlation length? Can we define how the correlation length is changing as a function of different parameters? So the question we were facing was really, it boils down to this. That is, we look at these images. And you can remind yourself of the conversation between Hamlet and Polonius. That is, depending on what your mood is, you can look at this and say, oh, I see a big patch that's going around, you know, 4 by 20. And then if your friend might say, no, I see something that's like 4 by 4. That's very impressionistic. And what we wanted to do was to take this enormous amount of data and figure out a simple way to think about it. By the way, I want to give credit to Sudip for this quote. It's not that I know Shakespeare that well to quote this. It's not my native language. So what we wanted was an objective measure. That is, rather than looking at this image, which has a lot of information, we wanted to find maybe something that will do this. So this is to keep you awake, because I will define what it is by the end of the talk. But what we found was that we could define a quantity that is a sharp measure of symmetry breaking. And when we studied it as a function of energy, we found that this actually has a very large correlation length. This is the field of view of 40 nanometer by 40 nanometer. So what were we after? Well, we look at this pattern and play the game of Hamlet and Polonius. What we are struggling with is the fact that a bunch of different types of symmetries are being broken. There is translational symmetry breaking, and there is rotational symmetry breaking. And what we wanted was, if we want to try to address this electron liquid crystalline physics, we wanted to be able to tell apart rotational symmetry breaking from translational symmetry breaking. And what we needed was a measure that is preserving the translational symmetry. Now, what's nice about being a young person in a mature field is that you get to stand on the shoulder of giants. And what's challenging about being a young person is that you have to come up with something new to add to it. So, I did my homework to try to do the literature search, but if I left you out, please educate me. But these were efforts of trying to quantify what's being seen in STM. This is the quantity called Z, which measures the asymmetry as a function of energy. There's a quantity called R, which is the ratio of tunneling currents. And also there was an effort to look for correlation length of stripes, making use of free filtering technique. So given what we've learned over the time, we try to think of a way of looking for orientational symmetry, measure of orientational symmetry that is translational symmetry, symmetry preserving. So one way to think about that is if you Fourier transform this image, you get various features. One of the features you see is these Bragg peaks. Perhaps you don't pay attention to Bragg peaks. Perhaps your students symmetrize them before they report to you. Because it's just Bragg peak. What's nice about Bragg peak is that it's translational symmetry preserving. And there are other features which appears more vivid to our eyes just because that's the way our eyes perceive things, which is this modulation-related peaks, which has to do with these modulations that we see. Now, we had this idea, rather than saying we should be more precise, it was really Michael's idea, who said, well, maybe we can think of these different peaks like different radio channels. So let's try to see if we can tune to the radio channel of interest and see what that tells us. So we go to Bragg peak. Well, this is what you find in Ashcroft and Merman. This D is the internal positions within a unit cell. R is the location of the atoms that's forming the unit cell. So we are interested in copper unit cell here. And D is going to be the location of all the things that you have inside a copper unit cell. Now, if I have something like this going on, this pattern, which has a different contrast between two oxygen sites that are 90 degree rotated, related to each other, this pattern preserves translational symmetry, but it breaks rotational symmetry. And if we look at these Bragg peaks and construct an order parameter like this, which is looking at the difference between one component of the Bragg peak and its 90 degree rotated partner, and making a combination such that this would correspond to something like a quadrupolar moment, this measures C4 symmetry breaking, just like quadrupolar moment in a classical liquid crystal that you detect with light scattering was a way to detect the existence of pneumatic in classical systems. We wanted to apply this measure to VSCO to see what that tells us. And the thing to notice here is that if you had nothing but the copper sites, this is going to give identically zero. So in order for this measure to give you non-zero signal, you need more structure inside a unit cell than just the copper site. That also says it requires the resolution to be able to study the subatomic scale features. And also we have to be able to actually correct for any kind of piezo drift or so on. So we put in a lot of effort to processing the data in a way that we correct for all those features. And I should point out that this idea of thinking about copper sites and oxygen sites together was perhaps presented by Vic Emery in 1987 for the first time. If this was not the first time and if it happened earlier, please correct me. I will stand corrected. Kivelson, Fredkin, and Jubal mentioned, they pointed out in this paper that if you want to think about a real space, a microscopic model of pneumatic, you have to involve the oxygen sites. So we had this measure, and we wanted to apply that. And this is what we find. So we did this study on under the 45 Kelvin data. which is published data in this Nature paper by Yuki Kusaka and others. And what you find is the following. This dashed line is the equivalent quantity calculated from the topograph. So the point of showing the quantity that's calculated from the topograph and the quantity that we get from the Z-map is to show that the signal we have is above the noise level. And you can see that it's got various energy dependencies, but it's basically non-zero over a large range of energy, and it really picks up around 40, 50 electron volts. Now, this is essentially averaging over the whole system. I boiled down the whole system's information about rotational symmetry breaking into a single number. But then we wanted to study correlation length. Can we try to do statistical mechanics? Can we try to define domains? So if we try to define domains, there's a movie coming up and it's very slow to load. Weird. Why isn't it loading? Yeah, let's see. I have the actual Saw movie. Why don't I just pick it up? Tip 1 dot open red. So the domains are this color, this side is one direction of ordering, and this side is another direction of ordering. You find that low energies, you can see why the signal when you average over looked kind of small. It was about 20%, because there seemed to be more, the domain size seemed to be smaller. But if you go to above 70, 60, somewhere around, it starts to take over and color the whole field of view. So this says the whole field of view is pretty much has a broken symmetry in one particular direction. Now, we can contrast this to the other channel, which is a translational symmetry breaking channel. And let's see, now if I can pull up that movie. Well, I said this is very recent, and this was like recent up to hours, kind of recent. This one, right? Now, this is what happens to the translational symmetry breaking signal. So it sort of grows as the translational symmetry preserving signal grows, but the correlation length always remains much smaller. So the hypothesis here is that perhaps there is both translational symmetry breaking and rotational symmetry breaking, but the directional order seems to maintain much longer correlation length. So that was the hypothesis. And now, testing this hypothesis is no longer my job. Discovery is the job of experimentalists. But we can look back on the history and what was what we found earlier. This was pointed out to me by Peter Bamonte, who told me about this interesting paper by Charlie Lever. They were looking at the melting of the charge density wave system, and they state that when the disorder turns on, the dislocations break the translational symmetry into small domains, but the orientational symmetry is longer range. Now, this is the quality of data they had, and this is their interesting way of analysis. That is, observed by viewing the images at a glancing angle along the indicated direction. So our goal was to make progress on that aspect. That is, you know, I don't know what the glancing angle is, and I don't know whether my eyes are better than your eyes, but I wanted a number. So this is where this is the progress we made over, you know, 10, 12 years, 20 years, and that's exciting. So let me try to wrap up now. Looking ahead, these are the kind of things that I would like to not challenge, but politely request to experimentalists. We would like to look at the doping dependence. How does these domains behave? What is the magnitude of order parameter? Is this something that's related to pseudo-gap? I don't know. The temperature dependence, it's a sharp signature. Broken symmetry is a sharp statement. You should be able to look at it as a function of temperature and identify where it happens. Now, another really exciting thing about this measure that we came up with is that it is a measure that is very friendly towards diffraction measurement. So perhaps one can try to do resonant inelastic X-ray scattering and look for the same kind of signature. I know this as a fact while I was talking to a student who was doing some measurements in some other doping range. He sent me the data, and I looked at it, and it looked very symmetric. And I asked the student, did you symmetrize this? And he said, of course, it's a Bragg peak. And I said, no, I don't want something symmetrized. So these are the things that we need to study experimentally. Now, theoretically, what we should think about is why would Cooper rates do this if we can be assured that this is really happening? And we can ask whether it's good or bad. And I haven't made any investment on that. Either way, we will learn how to improve on the condition of TC. So on that note, thank you for your attention, and that's all I had to say. Yes?
Interesting story, Una. Very short question from my side. I would expect, right, you're basically saying the translational correlation length is way shorter than the rotational one.
It appears to be from the data.
I think it's quite clear. I would think that you can then identify somehow dislocations, right? They make up the difference.
Right.
Have you kind of
right.
seen
so
them?
The boundaries between two colors that we were presenting earlier would be where you would expect these defects and so on. But as I said, this is like within last 3 hours or 4 hours, because I didn't get a lot of sleep, kind of analysis. We have a lot more to study.
Okay. I expect questions. I start in the back, and then I work to the front. It's like sports.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You have a state which breaks both translational and rotational symmetry?
Well, I was making the statement at the local level, okay? When I want to say symmetry breaking, usually, if I assume a homogeneous system, I will report a single number. If you have a magnet, you report the magnetic moment. The one number that I was reporting earlier as a function of energy, which was average over the whole sample, I was just reporting the magnitude of rotational symmetry breaking. But then I went into the positions and looked for the signatures of translational symmetry breaking and the signatures of rotational symmetry breaking. And from the real space image, I find that there are smaller domains for translational symmetry breaking than the rotational symmetry breaking. Does that make sense?
But you still call this state a pneumatic?
Right. I call this a pneumatic because if the translational symmetry breaking signatures are fluctuating in space or energy or whatever, so that the domains are so small, I wouldn't be able to say, I mean, if there is no net expectation value over the whole system. What I do find is that there is 20% of rotational symmetry breaking signal when I averaged over the whole system. So that I know for sure is happening.
Perhaps, I mean, the kind of cartoon I have in my head is, imagine that you have a quantum liquid crystal, and you hit it with this order, and it starts to localize.
Right.
And here and there you get patches of translational order.
Right. That's sort of the picture I have. Right.
Ali.
The procedure you describe is very useful.
Thank you.
But.
Oh.
As I'm sure your Cornell experimental colleagues will tell you, that the STM measurement often involves asymmetries having to do with the shape of the tip.
Right.
So what I wonder is whether you can simulate and think about how we might be able to take that out of the data, or how do you fundamentally get around this problem if you're just given limited amount of information?
Well, first of all,
I'm asking the question here.
First of all, it's not me, but my experimental colleagues who have to struggle with this question. However, as I said, I have excellent colleagues, which meant.
No, but they can't know the shape of their tip. So what I'm asking is a theoretical question. There is a way we can have a consistency check to pull back something about how the data was measured to make sure.
So first of all, I mean, certainly we can try to simulate and try to figure out sort of a theoretical prediction for processing the data to tell whether the tip effect is there or not. Simplest thing we can think of is that the tip effect wouldn't have energy dependence, but that's sort of a, you have to be friend to believe that. Now, what I was showing earlier, we have actually looked for this signal in at least four different parts of the sample with using different tips. There is a varying degree in terms of magnitude. So I cannot report the magnitude between its 20% or 23%. However, the magnitude of the order parameter is always well beyond the noise level that you can see from the topograph. And there were times when, if you look at the whole system, part of it looked one direction and part of it looked the other direction. Now, the only reason why I had this number of different data sets is because my colleague Andy Schmidt was suspecting that there might be a tip effect when he was doing the measurement, and he took a lot of data using a number of different tips. So I'm very lucky.
Okay, let's continue. Peter.
I noticed that the large change in your order parameter occurs around 30 millivolts, which is the scale of the kink that Seamus showed us before in his data. This is separating what we are now coming to believe are homogeneous, well-characterized D-wave quasi-particle states from something else. Do you have any comment on that, what's happening? And it's also, of course, the scale, or close to the scale, where Kosaka et al. Reported that the quasi-particle interference disappears and the quasi-particle energy, constant energy contour tips touch the anti-ferromagnetic zone phase. So how does that all fit together?
I have my dreams that will keep me from sleeping, which is perhaps this is a characteristic of pseudogap. But I don't. We don't have enough. We haven't done enough systematic study to see whether we can really nail that down. But that will be the analysis that we need to do. We have to look at this in many different data sets. First of all, as Ali correctly pointed out, because we don't have a good control over the magnitude itself, and it's sort of a broad, smooth kind of feature right now, so I can't really state it definitely. But we are observing that correlation between where the pattern turns on at the energy scale that you're referring to and where this seems to be turning on.
Can I see once again fingers to time the business? Okay, I move to Eduardo. Okay, so this is a suggestion to the experimentalists, actually to Seamus. It would be very nice to repeat some of these studies. In fact, you did some of that earlier on in at finite magnetic fields. We know that in LSCO there is an induced spin density wave there, there's sort of a stripe state that sets in. And we now know, at least in LBCO and in LSCO as well, that there is this dynamical layer decoupling effect that takes place. There is no, aside from your data at the moment, there is no other evidence for charge order in disco, but it will be very interesting to understand what happens in that regime at high fields. Because I think, in particular, doing these sort of studies that Una reported today would be particularly interesting in that regime.
So I had one quick comment, which is that assuming this order is short range, and it seems to get to be as big as your field of view, but it's still probably short range, diffraction may not be the best way to see it. On the other hand, if there are these large differences between local differences between the oxygens in one direction and the other, mm-hmm. that should be able to be picked up very simply in NQR as a bulk measurement. And so I don't know if such data exists. People seem to have stopped doing NMR on the cuprate, but I think that now there's a very strong motivation to look for that. I had a very quick question. Have you measured a correlation length of the orientational order parameter?
We did study the correlation length. In defining correlation length in a way that I guess can pass the standards of Jim Cessna is still under development. He's a statistical mechanician. He has standards about correlation length. We've studied the correlation length, but at the moment, probably what your eyes are seeing, that is this field of view, seems to be the best measure. But that's what we want to do now, now that we have a clear measure. Translational correlation length, the domain size was much smaller. So when we were first looking at just the translational symmetry breaking signal and try to look for in the entire field of view, where is plus and where is minus and where is zero, larger part of real estate was taken in the gray area. That was the challenge. But when we turned into the rotational symmetry sensitive measure, large part of the field of view is taken at above certain energy scale by one color.
Are there more questions? I mean, perhaps, I guess it's a bit early for coffee. I'll take the liberty just to make it somewhat more. Oh, I see Mike. And then I do myself a short comment. And
I mean, this is related to Steve's comment. So, I mean, these kind of short-range patterns have been seen in manganites by diffuse scattering. So I think if there's this question about surface versus bulk, I think diffuse scattering analysis should see these kind of patterns. They've seen them in other transition metal oxides. So
let me make shortly my comment, and it's related to, you know, I get quite excited when I see it because it sort of resonates with theoretical work we did in the past of a kind where you really know that you can do theoretical work, which is kind of non-trivial. And it's related to the idea that when you're dealing with bosonic matter, so you're seeing that the stripes are made out of Cooper pairs, that's the essential idea, then you have field theory that can really work for you. Now, from that perspective, you find out that in the case that the correlation lengths are large, you can view the liquid crystal, the dramatic crystal, as actually a Bose condensation of dislocations. Right, so you have a crystal, you hit it with quantum dislocations, they both condense, and because of that you restore translations and you end up with liquid crystalline order. Now when you have this picture in your head, this becomes very, very meaningful, because we have Bill Anderson here in the audience, and he figured out a long time ago that when you have quantum mechanical matter and you have disorder, you get Anderson localization. But now your quantum mechanical matter is dislocations, they are supposed to energy localize because they're quantum mechanical, and when they do so, actually the translational order comes up again because the dislocations hide that from your view. So what I read in this analysis. No, but this is a short comment. I want to remind you, Eduardo, that I got an invitation to be an active chair, so I take that opportunity. I make my money. So the real question is, I think to the experimentalist, can you sort of identify these Anderson localized dislocations? Can you correlate where you see that the translational order gets screwed up with events where you have more disorder in your lattice, where you see actually the dislocations in your substructure coming up? Okay. In the light of Eduardo's view on this meeting. Okay, Marvin, you are the very last one.
It was a very nice talk. But I felt some age discrimination.
Oh. Okay.
One more.
I would just like to mention that the domains in BISCO of a size of about 8 to 10 unit cells have been observed as a two-dimensional short-range order some years ago.
Right. So
with
this
doubling
was
of
how
the unit cell along the orthorhombic direction, not the cubic direction. Not necessarily, because if you double the unit cell along the diagonal, you make a unit cell which along the A axis and B axis are exactly four unit cells. And what?
To the
it's not because
the
repeat unit is maybe along the diagonal, but the object can be elongated along the other direction. Now, one thing which I am surprised with is about BISCO, that one completely neglects the long-range modulation, which is extremely strong, and which makes the system highly orthorhombic, if you have a single... Pardon?
So, the symmetry that you are referring
no,
to...
No, you have single-domain crystals, where the...
So here is the orthorhombic axis. That's the superlattice modulation piece. These are the superlattice modulation, and this is the orthorhombic axis. And the difference between QX and QY, the superlattice modulation is a near plane.
I'm saying that's a conclusive final word. Let's go for coffee and get back in half an hour.